He said he started blacking out when his kids were small. So he isn't averse to talking about his family. You know, Bill, you could talk about your son.
No.
Try.
I'm not discussing my son with him.
Well, you don't have to talk about your family. You can make one up. It's just about building rapport. He asked for stuff. Cigarettes, pizza. Indulge him.
But you had interests by then.
Stealing lingerie off of clotheslines.
You photographed a neighborhood girl naked when you were 15.
Just a healthy, red-blooded American male.
What about the shoes?
What shoes?
In your garage. The women's shoes.
The wife loved to shop.
There were nearly 100 pairs, most of them size 16.
Ah, those. Friends sent those to me.
Friends?
That's right.
Why would friends send you shoes?
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today in the studio is
Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, where Jim's my colleague, and I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. And one of those minds is not here with us today.
Yes, Laura Richards is off the continent and hopefully having some peaceful time away from crime and murder, but she's here in spirit.
Yeah, she's in an undisclosed tropical location, probably riding dolphins or something like that. So we're going to get back to our conversation about the Netflix series Mindhunter, and we're just about to start episode 7.
Yeah, so we've talked about episode 1 through 6 and how much we were really enthralled by this series so far, and episode 7 does not disappoint.
Right. So, Jim, as I rewatched it this morning before coming here, I'm really glad I did because I noticed all kinds of things that totally nerded me out. But they start the episode just with a laugh. A really annoying laugh and this chatter. Some guy is like just chattering about some Muhammad Ali fight, okay, which, you know, sets us in a time.
Right.
And everything, he's chattering and chattering. And we see Holden and Bill going into this penitentiary in Salem, Oregon. And it's a really long entrance. I notice that they have to go through all of this security. I mean, much more so than we've seen in the past. So we see this guy coming in. He's a big guy, just like Kemper.
Yeah, he's not quite as big as Kemper,
yeah,
but
right.
Yeah, he's a big guy.
Right, right. Redheaded guy, again, my favorite thing.
I hope the serial killer thing and the fetishes hopefully put you off from that a little bit.
No, definitely. I just mean that he's very unique looking. And he's played by this great actor, Happy Anderson. What a name, right?
Yeah, yeah, it sounds like an Adam Sandler character.
Right, right, Happy Madison. Yeah. So he comes shuffling in. He seems to be like this jovial, jolly guy. He comes shuffling in with the guard, who is very stoic. You know, he's not like engaging with this guy at all. And in the middle of him being all jovial, the guard tries to take his hand and he just like grabs his hand. And it's just, and this is constantly what this character does in the scene. Like, you think he's one thing, and then he changes tone very, very quickly.
Right, he tries to throw them off.
Right.
Definitely. I mean, just like he's totally disinterested, sits facing away from them, totally disengages them, you know, ordering them around, all sorts of stuff, because he's trying to throw his weight around.
That's right. And the two agents are kind of looking at each other like, okay, what should we do? They have a gut instinct on what to do, but Dr. Wendy is like, no, stick to the form. We're trying to codify this. And so they start trying to read the questionnaire, and he's just very bored by that.
Yeah. Well, and this points out a really interesting fact of the real-life investigations that we did in the behavioral analysis unit. You're dealing with human beings. And yes, you want to do empirical studying. And at this point, actually, they were doing anecdotal studies. And so Dr. Wendy is supposed to be characterizing the shift from anecdotal to empirical. And eventually we would get there. But it takes a long time to do that. And you have to always dial in the fact that every single offender is going to be unique. And every single offender is going to need nuanced changes in how you approach them and how you draw information out of them. And there'll be a number of categories of types of offenders. And some are going to be bragging. Some want to go down in history. Some will be still fighting appeals and will never want to admit anything. So they'll talk as if, well, the killer would have done that. The killer would have done this. Or they'll talk in terms of, well, if I had done it, I would have done it that way. Pull an OJ on him. So there's all sorts of different ways this information comes out. And the job of the profiler is to get in there and get the guy to talk and to get the guy to reveal truths about what he was doing and thinking and his behavior and his history. And that is a way to help us build profiles in the future.
Right. And at this point, Jerry, he's denying everything that they tried to bring up and just saying, oh, I was drugged. This was coerced. They threatened me. They didn't let me talk to my wife. They threatened my kids. You know, he's just... But he's over-exaggerating his innocence. So they have to go off script. Bill goes up off script and gets Jerry to admit that he has a shoe fetish. And they start showing him pictures of himself in the shoes, you know, trying to get him to engage with it, I guess, or brag about it.
Well, basically what it is, actually, it's different. They're trying to separate him from his defenses. Mm-hmm. In other words, the more they can get him locked into his fantasy, the more his mind will be focused on that. He's been away from his shoes and away from his sexual fantasies for a long time. So by engaging him in those fantasies, they know that his defenses are going to come down. And then they'll take that to the extreme here when they actually buy a pair of shoes, right?
Right.
And
exactly.
They see right away how intense that fantasy is, because he takes a shoe and starts masturbating with it.
Right.
And not shy about it, you know, right there in front of the FBI agents, right there. And
have you ever seen somebody like that? I mean, do you like almost show off for you with their fetish or with their...
I think I've definitely interviewed prisoners in this process, convicted murderers and convicted serial rapists who absolutely want to brag to us, who absolutely want to prove how great they were. And so they'll edit out all the mistakes they made, and they'll even sometimes try to explain away stuff like that. Well, you know, I knew the cops were so dumb, so I didn't have to worry about that part.
Right.
Something like that. But yeah, absolutely. I've seen guys, and they're scary, and you go in there and you're completely unprotected. You can't do anything to defend yourself because you don't have your gun.
I want to just point this out to you, and we can cut this, but I want you to look at this composition on the screen here, where you see what's great about this is you see everybody's face. You don't have to do a lot of cutting. If you see, so Jerry's in the foreground, his back is to the agents, but you can still see like the agents are stacked behind him. So you can see everybody's.
So it's a three shot and they're not facing each other.
Yeah.
So you get everybody's face, yeah.
And I love how, if you remember back when they were interviewing Kemper, they were just sort of like in a cinder block room. It didn't particularly look like a prison. But in this scene, he's like in a cage within a cage. I mean, it's a very different kind of a vibe that Fincher's going for. So, you know, I'm going to geek out about this
Sorry. That's fine.
Anyway. Oh, okay. So at the end of the scene, I love this. So he kind of looks at them and is like, you know, Kemper was right. You guys are fucking idiots. And the boy,
like, what?
Our guys are like, what?
Yeah, we talk to each other.
Is that at all possible? Could that have at all, you know?
Well, let me put it this way. Have you heard of prison kites?
No.
All right. Kites are how messages are exchanged in prison. And a lot of times what it's done is you write a note, you tie a string to it or a long thread, and you throw it down to the next cell. And once they get it, then they take the whole thing and the thread. Because if you don't get it to them all the way, then you have to be able to pull it back and try again.
Sure.
So that's why, you know, that's where the name kite comes from. And so they get it to the one who has the relationship with the guard, who is willing to take notes out for them and bring them to someplace else or mail them and things like that. So, yes, it is possible. It would have been a long, arduous process, but I would think that the fact that he knew that they talked to Kemper probably indicates that, in fact, it was true.
Right, and they're they're crestfallen by this because it could mess up all the data that they're trying to, that they're being played on a totally different level.
They thought they had unique access to these prisoners, and they found out that they did not. And that was, like you said, very devastating to their cause.
Although later we'll see that Dr. Wendy is like, oh, no, this is awesome. You know, what do they have to say to each other? Let's study what their conversation is. But before they leave, what I love is Holden looks at Bill and goes, do you really think Kemper called us idiots? Like, he's like, his feelings are hurt. And I mean, I can imagine that if you think you have a rapport with a serial killer and you hear that they're kind of shitting on you behind your back, I mean, is that like he's getting too close? Like, he's getting too personally involved with this?
Well, I mean, you know, remember, this is a
a
dramatic depiction,
of course,
as opposed
to
reality.
Of
but
course.
Yeah, that's what they're trying to show, that he cares too much about them. The fact is that one key element to getting these guys to talk is building rapport. Mm. And when you're building rapport, you're giving of yourself. You're making yourself vulnerable. And, you know, and so if somebody throws that back in your face, you know, that's taking advantage of that vulnerability.
Yeah. So they leave and they're going to go back and give Dr. Wendy their findings. There's this little scene that happens on the plane where, you know, they're sitting together on the plane. And, oh, there's a really funny line where Holden says, maybe we should call Kemper and ask him. and Bill's like, ask him if he called us idiots, then we really would be idiots. I mean, I just love that. But, you know, Bill is in the center seat, and this nebbishy guy comes up and is like, you're in my seat, and, like, will not, like, and the aisle seat is usually the better seat,
right?
And so he won't switch seats. And so what do? During the plane flight, they just start passing back their research. And the guy's like, okay, I'll change my seat. And Bill's like, no, yeah, actually, I kind of like being on the aisle.
Yeah.
He's going to fuck with them. But anyway.
Fuck me, fuck you. That's what he said.
Exactly. So they take it back to Dr. Wendy, and she's listening. And she's like, excited at the idea that the two serial killers could have been talking to each other. She doesn't think that this damages their data at all.
Well,
it's just,
I don't think she understands.
Yeah.
I mean, how could she not? That's so ridiculous. I mean, obviously, when you have subjects that are being studied, them talking to each other and discussing what the first one, discussing what he had heard and what he was asked and what he said with the second one taints the second one's answers.
Right. But she's sort of got a bigger picture idea about it. And actually, she starts to talk about how these are two very different killers, and they're it's a new behavior, post-conviction admission or denial. One is lying and overly exaggerating, and the other one is telling the truth and being overly forthcoming. You know, so I guess this is part something she's really excited about.
Yeah, well, she's learning how the different convicted serial killers will respond to questioning. And, you know, how we got most of them to talk was saying, hey, you tell us the truth, you'll go down in history. You know, we'll preserve this forever and ever and ever.
Yeah. And she suggests that they actually offer up more personal talk, offer up more personal details about their own lives in order to get them to talk.
That's the rapport building, right?
Yeah, and Bill's like, no, I'm not gonna fucking talk to him about my son, but she's like, just use anything, get him the pizza he wants, get him the cigarettes, you know, use anything. One thing to notice about this scene is her blouse, how yellow that blouse. She's wearing a very yellow blouse with this arrowhead pattern on it, whereas the guys are just in these very pale, you know, pale shirts, very, what would you call it? It's like the FBI uniform, you know, dark ties, pale shirts. So she's, and this is a choice. You know, this is something that Fincher is doing to shake up the visual, saying that she's not a part of this. She's disrupting the space with not only her gender, but the color that she's wearing. She's jarring with them, and her ideas are jarring with them too.
He took a hacksaw and cut off one of her feet. He saved that as a trophy, put it in the freezer that he had, periodically took it out. It was a fetish item, and put a female shoe on it, masturbated, got sexual arousal from it.
Bill then gets this idea to talk to Jerry's ex-wife, and he has just a very brief conversation with her. She won't really talk to him, but she does say, is this about Jer? And she says, look, I changed my name for a reason, and hangs up on him. Right. He doesn't get much out of her.
But he uses that.
He uses that. That's right. Okay.
And that's smart, and that's what you got to do. And by using some little tidbit like that, it implies that you have much deeper knowledge than you actually do. And so that sometimes is a way to get people to tell more than they want to tell.
Okay. So next scene, Holden and Deb, his girlfriend, they go shopping, and she has a little comment saying, gosh, you really should have bought those two shirts. You know, they looked really great on you. And he's like, no, I don't like patterns, you know, and he's just so Squaresville. He's just so trapped in his own sort of vanilla. Like, I can't take any.
Let me just tell you, though, John Douglas has beautiful clothing. I mean,
I'm sure he does.
Dresses so well. I mean, he has these a trademark bright blue, like steel blue shirt that he wears, and they're very well made, and I'm sure very expensive. So that part is not accurate.
Yeah. John Douglas is like. Noted, duly noted. So they go into this shoe store, and she tries to get him to try on these John Travolta boots, which I thought were awesome. But he gets this idea in the shoe store, and the idea is, do you remember?
Yeah, basically he sees the. He sees the pumps, and he realizes that this is a opportunity to get some fetish material for Brutus, and that he will sort of take advantage of that fantasy and further distract Brutus and get him to reveal more about himself unwillingly.
Right. So when they go back to see Brutus this time, they're ready for him, you know. The scene starts with his laugh. You hear his very annoying laugh and patter. And as he enters, again, it's a cage within a cage within a cage, mm-hmm. sort of like this animal entering this cage. But they're standing there, ready to go. And
the subtlety of that, he takes his jacket off and off the box mm-hmm. and puts it on, as if it's inadvertent that he's now disclosing the fact that he has a shoebox there. And that subtlety is how we learned from our predecessors how to actually really manipulate offenders. Because if you put it right in their face, they're going to know, oh, they're doing this to manipulate you. Yeah. But if you kind of keep it in the background, and if you let them notice it themselves in their own time, it becomes much more of an obsessive thing.
Absolutely.
So I thought they did a great job with that.
And you can clearly see the size 16 wide on the box.
I'm sure it makes it easier for them in school.
Yeah, what would they say to their friends? Not just about the murders. How do you explain the cross-dressing? Dad's a tranny? Dad's a fag?
Fuck you, man.
How does it fucking work with the shoes?
He is dying to know.
I'll pass it along to Darcy. 10 years later, she's still confused.
Give her my love.
I'll do that.
Jer.
Right. So he uses that little thing. Like, she really didn't talk to him, but he knew that little thing would get to him.
Right. So this is a great example of a paraphilia. So paraphilia is a sexual attraction to an inanimate object or a non-consenting party. And so the scenario that plays out right here is that they give him the shoes. He takes them out. He goes over to another bench, faces away from him, and presumably masturbates with or into mm-hmm. the shoes. And that is because those shoes are what sexually arouse him, as opposed to the person who might be wearing those shoes.
But then how does that paraphilia, which, you know, is benign in a way because it's not hurting anybody, but he escalates that to wanting to cut the feet off of women who are wearing the shoes. Like, and I think later he explains that he kills them first, kind of gets that out of the way, and then plays with them.
Right, because he was a necrophile. So part of his fantasy is the dead victim. And so he has now dehumanized the victim and depersonalized them and objectified them by only focusing on part of their anatomy, you know, their feet. And so he incorporates that into the fantasy, and it becomes a driving force in him killing victims, four victims at least.
And we don't know how that change evolves from something, or even just wanting to dress in women's clothes, you know, that
kind of thing. I mean, as everything else, it's a complicated mix of biopsycho and social. So he had the genetic predisposition, his personality and psychology filter his experiences after that. And so by reinforcing that arousal pattern, by masturbating and thinking about killing women or having sex with parts of dead women and fantasizing about the shoes and the feet and not the woman and not relationship, by reinforcing that arousal pattern, you participate in that. It's not like it happened to you. Hmm. He is absolutely, affirmatively accepting and embracing that paraphilia, knowing that in order for him to actually get off sexually, he's going to have to take the lives of other people and mutilate their bodies and then have sex with their bodies afterwards.
Yeah.
So it's a choice.
It's a choice.
In that part,
yes.
Yeah.
And Bill is just over it. Like, Bill is, you know, I feel dirty, you know, dealing with this guy this way, even though we're getting information. So Holden also starts to share about his, he masturbated and his mom walked in on him in order to build a rapport with Jerry. Did you ever share anything that was real, or did you keep it like in fiction?
Well, just like it's lies of omission. You take bits and pieces of the truth and you weave in lies about it because you're dealing with, for example, a terrorist, a killer, a serial rapist, a serial murderer. You don't necessarily want them to know where you live and who your family members are and who they can come after or put somebody else on after you convict them. So you have to carefully construct things, keep them in your back pocket, and know how far you can go and how far you can't go. So, yeah, I have told offenders real things, but never enough to really put myself or anybody I know in danger.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong. If what we're doing doesn't get under your skin, you're either more screwed up than I thought or you're kidding yourself.
Right. So I thought that was an interesting, Bill thinks it's normal for him to be disgusted with this and that it's bothering him. And if it's not bothering you, then you're too close or you're just desensitized.
Well, that's one way of looking at it. The other thing is that if you actually develop a healthy clinical detachment, then it won't get under your skin. Then it won't bother you that way. I mean, when you realize it, when you take the 30,000-foot view of it, the overall picture is that we are trying to get information to help us stop killers in the future. And so we have to do certain things to accomplish that. And if you keep that in mind, it's easier to not get disgusted by the details. But yeah, I mean, I've had to say some pretty disgusting things to people and say, you know, that's okay, that doesn't bother me, at least you didn't do this, you know? And, you know, unfortunately, it's just part of the job.
Do you do research on Jerry Brudos? How does that work?
Oh, I certainly did, yeah. I read the book on him called Lust Killer and just kind of put together this idea of who I thought he was and then bring as much of myself as I could to it to keep it authentic, you know. It was difficult with a guy like Brutus who's so heinous and diabolical in his actions, but it's also kind of charming and kind of interesting.
Well, let me ask you, what do you make of this whole, you know, she's feeding the stray cat thing? I mean, I thought repeatedly that something bad was going to happen as a result of that, but it never really played out.
I know. She's a very, not lonely person, but she's a loner. She's by herself.
Solitary, yeah.
And this is something that she's very in reaching out for, trying to draw the cat maybe inside. And there's something very feline about her anyway, something about the way she moves, that she's sort of curious about it. I don't know. It's just a quirk and eccentricity. Whereas Bill would be like, get out of here, you know, or he would have shut the door. So they take the tape back to Wendy, and they think that she's going to be so impressed by the shoe and the masturbating and all that stuff that they got out of him, and she's just like disgusted by it. She thinks, oh, you were just having a pissing contest with him, and so you can't please her.
That's so wrong. I mean, I just don't get it at all. That's just wrong. But, you know, she's the foil.
Exactly.
Because when you have somebody who's very perceptive, they're going to know if you're just lying to them outright. and you won't be able to pull it off. And that's why you use lies of omission, because you can at least anchor your lies into something that's true, and you can focus on those things, and you can use those things to be corroborated.
So the next scene is with Bill and his wife. They're having a date night, and you realize that they're having a terrible time with their child that they've adopted, that he's not connecting with Bill at all, and the wife is just doing everything she can to think of how to break through his shell, take him to a music therapist, this or that, and Bill is very averse to therapy. Is that true in the FBI?
It's not just in the FBI. Yeah. Sure, in the FBI, definitely, because there was a point in time in which if you were in therapy in the FBI, you could lose your security clearance.
Why?
Because obviously if you're having mental stability issues, then somebody might be able to manipulate you, or there might be something that somebody could use to blackmail you. So that's what happens. Hmm. So there's that. And then on top of that, the fact that he basically, you know, he's the practical, feet on the ground, real world type person. And so he doesn't believe in all that mumbo jumbo. And so that's his role in this.
You know, obviously all of these agents have their own personal relationships going on. And how do you keep those relationships healthy when you have such pressures and you have such this inside look at such horror? And do you shield your partner from those, or do you share them? You know,
I know agents who've done both of those things, and I think it's a spectrum of behavior. I know that some people go home and they spill their guts to their wives or partners, and others say nothing to them. And I don't think holding everything back is healthy unless you have some other outlet. I always feel that balance is the key to maintaining proper mental health. You have to have something to release all that. You have some outlet, some creative thing that isn't dark, or else it's just going to pile up on you and, kill you.
Okay, so they come home and the babysitter, they realize that their child has found some files of his and has seen some very, very graphic images. And so the kid's freaked out. She's freaked out. So his work literally is exposed to everything.
Home.
And she finally realizes really what he does. I don't think his wife really knew the kind of explicit stuff he's around.
Well, he was trying to shelter her.
Right. And once she does, I think it was a very touching moment that she completely just embraces him and realizes what a burden he's been carrying around. And, oh my gosh, my heart just went out for this big lug.
Mm.
So the relationships that you form in this kind of work with your coworkers, that must be very intense.
It can be. I mean, there's a lot of – well, first of all, I think most of the people in the BAU are achievers, overachievers, type A personalities. So – sometimes you can bunk heads with them. People have very strong belief systems and perspectives. And so one of the processes that we go through is actually confronting each other from our own perspectives. And you have to justify what your perspective is. And it's a learning process. And I think it's the reason why we come up with such really good outcomes, is that we challenge each other, and in the end, what falls out of it is actually gold.
Right. And you have a diversity of experience. So in the scene, you see Holden kind of going through the process with Dr. Wendy, like, where did this fetish come from and how are they putting together the pieces? But I would imagine also the camaraderie is very special.
Yeah, you know, when you're going through hell together, you do get a certain kind of bonding there.
Yeah. So here we come to Holden and Deb. They're going to have dinner. They're going to make out. And I love that they play meatloaf in this scene. So she goes off to slip into something more comfortable. And she comes back, but she's wearing the same shoes that he gave to Jerry, which he just
throws them off.
Cannot get past that.
And he doesn't tell her, so it looks like something else. And it's just a bad move.
Right. So she feels really rejected. And, this is his work life just infiltrating his personal life.
Yeah.
Oh, and then he insults her like, this isn't you, which is, oh, this is that's not good. That's not a good thing to say. Anyway, so that wraps up episode 7.
Yeah.
Which is fun to kind of watch it with you at the same time, you know?
It's good seeing it again, yeah. So that's how episode 7 ends, and we'll be talking about episode 8 the next episode.
And it's probably one of the more controversial episodes. People have written to us so many times wanting to know what Jim thinks about the tickling teacher.
I will definitely be talking about that in our next episode of Real Crime Profile. Thanks for listening.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things that you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcast and leave us a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotion and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go over to Facebook and like our Facebook page. And one last thing is please tell all your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening to us. We really appreciate you.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website, www.genesisshelter.org, or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.